You remember the first day we talked about the whole question of us interpreting the Bible from the bottom. That is, assume for the moment that we try, as people who are actually in the elite top 10% of the world, to understand the text from the point of view of those people who are exploited or suffering or poor, those people at the bottom of society. And it's not an exercise in sheer futility. I think it's an exercise that's necessary if we, as people who are Christians, dare to do what Christ did, and that is to attempt to identify with the poor and to serve in the process of liberation and the struggle of the poor and the oppressed, to find salvation, to find hope, to find human dignity. On the first day, then, we looked at the example of Hagar as an Old Testament figure who tends to be put in the margin, when in fact she is a key figure in that story, and Hagar is a slave, and the slave produces a son who then becomes an heir in his own right. The second day we looked at Solomon as an example not of a man who is using his wisdom for justice but wisdom for power, and in fact turns out to be a tyrant and the oppressor of God's people instead of the Savior. The third day we looked briefly at Moses and his function as a liberator rather than a lawgiver as being pivotal to what his role was. And the fourth day, yesterday, we looked at Job and the question of whether or not those who suffer, whether they suffer individually like you or I may from some disease, or whether they suffer, as indeed the poor do, from generations upon generations of institutionalized poverty that is structured into the society which prevents those people from ever being free. And the cry to God and against God that is found in the book of Job is a cry which those people themselves can find a comfort, because they believe, or they can see how other men of God and women of God have in fact struggled and cried not just to God but against God, and God in his mercy and his grace is big enough to take it. Today we have come briefly to the New Testament, and the title that I've given today is Jesus is Lord, or Jesus the Lord ? And the reason I put it that way is that it is easy for us who live in an imperial type of society to identify with the lordship of Jesus rather than identifying with the other side of Jesus. And the reason I also say this is that the affirmation of Jesus as Lord is not the way Jesus operates when he is living on the earth and working with people. He doesn't come across as a Lord at all. Just the opposite. He comes across as one who is daring to identify not with those who are in authority in society, but those who are suffering in society. And so the lordship of Jesus is in fact a problem if we impose it upon Jesus as the human being suffering and working and struggling and liberating his people. The lordship is something we affirm after the ascension, after the resurrection of Christ, not something that we need to be, as it were, imposing upon the story prior to that point. So I think we need to see Jesus the sufferer, Jesus the man among the poor, as the person with whom we identify in the gospel stories. So with that background briefly, let's turn to a couple of the texts that people have suggested we look at as examples we might study. And if you don't have a New Testament, I think there may be a few more around that can be shared, some over there. We'll look first at Luke chapter 4, and this is the classic text that is cited by most of the people who are involved in the liberation struggle. And this particular text is a text where Jesus, you remember, starting from verse 16 of chapter 4, is a little country boy who apparently started off and on his own left home and was going around doing some preaching. And relatively early in his ministry, comes back to his hometown, to Nazareth, and it's a Sabbath day, and everybody's gathered in the synagogue, and so Jesus is in the synagogue, and he decides he is invited to read the lesson, like any number of us might be invited to read the lesson. Gets up to read the lesson, and he speaks very nicely, and modulates his voice well, and everybody's very impressed, until... Now, let's see what he read. He read from the prophet Isaiah, verse 18. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Now that is, with variations, is the text of Isaiah 61. And we'll come back to that text in a moment. Then, verse 20, he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And all spoke well of him, and he wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, "Isn't this Joseph's kid?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote me the proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself.' What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do also here in our country." And he said to them, "Truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his own country. But in truth I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when there was a great famine over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." And when they heard all this, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath. And they rose up, and they put him out of the city, and they led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him headlong down. But passing through the midst of them, he went away. Now, not many of us would get up to read the lesson on Sunday and then be lynched. So if he gets up and reads the lesson on Sunday, and it's so radical and so threatening to his hometown that they take him out to the hillside and kill the hometown boy, something very drastic and radical must be what he's saying. What is it? Why is it so strong, this particular action of Jesus? Well, let's go back to verse 18, which is the quotation from Isaiah 61. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. I am now, as it were, called, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, sent me to proclaim release to the captives, liberty to those who are oppressed, and proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." Now that particular statement is virtually the Magna Carta for Jesus' ministry. And if you ever want to know who Jesus is and what he's about, the first thing he says that he's going to do is this. Come back to that passage again and again and again and read what he did in the light of what he said his Magna Carta is. Circle this, square it, write on it. Don't be afraid that this is a sacred text. Make sure you can find this passage 100 times again. This is the Magna Carta of Jesus' ministry, of what he intends to do. He is going to preach good news to the poor. Now, why is that radical? Because the people who were there in the synagogue were not the poor. I'm not going to preach to you guys who are here on Sunday morning or Saturday morning. My task is to preach liberation to the poor. That's bad enough. I'm also going to proclaim release to the captives. Now, one of our problems is that we have always read passages like this to say, well, release to the captives means anybody who's got any kind of captivity. That you are captive to your greed, you're captive to your motor cars, your capitalism, whatever it is you're captive to, God is going to liberate you from. But when Jesus is talking in this text, there's no indication that he's talking about spiritual things first and foremost, but actual prisoners, actual poor. Not you and me, but actual prisoners and actual poor and actual blind and actual people who are being oppressed by the Jews in their society, the slaves of society. Now, if that's the case, this text is not really just directed, as we frequently read it, interpret it for ourselves, to those people who are suffering from neurosis or whatever your captivity might be, but the people in that society. So he is threatening that he will preach a message that's going to overthrow the social structures. That's why they're upset. And the key text, which we don't understand at all most of the time, is the last line, "and proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord," which is another way of saying the Jubilee year. To understand that, you need to have some idea of the Old Testament background. In the Old Testament, there was a an ideal way in which the world ought to distribute its resources. Now that ideal was never lived up to by the Jews, but the ideal is there, that after every 7 years you should lie, have your land lie fallow. Any servants or slaves that you've got who has in slavery to you because they couldn't pay their debts, you've got to let them go. Everything is to revert back. And then after 7 times 7, in the 49th year, which is the Jubilee year, the acceptable year of the Lord, which he's referring to here, that year all land that you might have that you got from somebody else goes back. All credit you have goes back. The whole credit card system in the country would fall apart if you did that. There's no way that an economy which is structured on having some people control other people's money and wealth and slaves can handle this unless they prepare for it as fundamental to their philosophy of redistribution of wealth back to the people to whom it belongs, where everybody has a piece of land and everybody has their liberty and freedom. Now that, you see, is a very radical statement. Now in this man, in his book, whom a book I've mentioned before, Robert McAfee Brown, he has a discussion of this text as well. It's the book called Unexpected News, Reading the Bible with Third World Eyes, and he's doing essentially what I'm doing, asking what it's like if you read the text from the bottom. And he has summarized what this text would sound like in the ears of those people who were listening. Very briefly. The land is not to be exploited anymore. Slaves are to be set free. Debts are to be canceled. Capital unjustly gained is to be redistributed. Any political, economic, social, or religious structures that perpetuate exploitation must be changed to create a society committed to the reversal of the plight of the poor, the blind, and the oppressed, and all others. The provisions of the Jubilee are not spiritual consolation, for those who fail to make it here and now, they're not spiritual consolation prizes for those who fail to make it here and now, but they are specific descriptions of what the here and now is already in the process of becoming. In other words, the acceptable year of the Lord is not some kind of spiritual salvation, but is in fact something that relates to what ought to be happening in the structure of society. Now that's the kind of radical thing they would have heard. And that would have upset the Pharisees, who were amongst the leading people of society and had their servants and their slaves, etc., etc. Questions? Comments? Yeah.
Is there a reason why you missed that line, set to heal the brokenhearted? I noticed that you didn't refer to that any time that you read it.
Which translation do you have?
ESV, I guess. Isn't that in your text?
RSV. No, it doesn't say that in mine.
What? To preach the gospel to the poor, he has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captive, and so forth.
To heal the brokenhearted. That's it. That translation must be what? What's the translation? Is it the way?
The living.
Ah, the Living Bible, please. The Living Bible is out. That's one of the problems of the Living Bible. The Living Bible will...
Yeah,
please. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. The problem with the Living Bible, I'll make this point, I'm not against many things, but I have a real problem with the Living Bible. This illustrates the point. They have spiritualized the text right there. The brokenhearted, not the poor. The poor are the poor. Huh?
Yeah, I've got the King James.
Ah, you got the King James? Then in fact that too is, the poor is the Greek text. And that, if it's the King James, that's also then corrected in the Revised Standard Version. The Hebrew.
Poor and brokenhearted.
The poor and brokenhearted.
You have anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, and you have sent me to heal the brokenhearted.
Ah. Oh, then it... Okay, well, I'll grant that must be in there, but it's not in the Greek text that I have here, and the Revised Standard Version is the basic text. The problem, I will make a point about the Living Bible, though. Regardless of this particular item, the Living Bible is a text which, in many, many places, paraphrases in a spiritualizing way and takes away from the punch of the text. Or it For example, it in the book of John, the first chapter, you've got this very basic text. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Living Bible starts, in the beginning was Christ. Now, you have immediately taken away from that fundamental thing, which is pre, that is the Word is something far bigger, and whereas Christ is a specific historical person. You have interpreted the text in such a way that you have limited all sorts of other deeper dimensions of meaning in that text. So that happens a number of times in the Living Bible, and for that reason I don't ever use it as a text. Yeah. But in this particular point, there must be a second line in some of the Greek texts which have been included in the Living Bible.
But it's in the Isaiah passage, maybe that has something.
Ah, that's different. Yeah, they've incorporated the Isaiah passage into the New Testament text. Good point. Thank you.
Isn't there a brokenheartedness that goes along with being poor?
Oh, that's true. That's true. But what happens if you...
That doesn't need to... I mean, it's misinterpreted.
No, it's easily said that the brokenhearted... Sure, there's a brokenhearted, there's a breaking of spirit that goes along with being poor and depressed. Right, that's correct. But it's... What's happened, I'm trying to get at, is that we've so easily spiritualized this passage instead of saying this does really refer to the poor. Right. Now, let me refer to another passage where the same thing happens. And I mentioned it at the very first lecture. In the Sermon on the Mount, we have this passage, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall inherit the earth." And it goes on in a similar vein. But if you look at Luke, which is the earlier version of that text, it says, "Blessed are the poor," not "blessed are the poor in spirit." And you have, as it were, the spiritualized version which comes early in the piece, and the original text, both in that verse and in the verses that follow, he says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who hunger," not "those who hunger and thirst after righteousness." Blessed are those who hunger. He's got the hard, down-to-earth version, whereas the Matthew has a much more spiritual version of the same sermon. And it's very useful to recognize that tendency is there from the very beginning, to take it away from the hard kind of reality of people who are suffering to a more general kind of understanding.
Norman?
Yeah.
Given the fact that there are about 48 translations now, which one is the most accurate as well as being readable?
Good question. We'll have 48 different answers. Around this room. I object to the Living Bible because it's a paraphrase and not a translation. If you want to paraphrase, but remember you've got a bias in a particular direction. Second, I think for ordinary everyday people who find the Revised Standard Version still a little bit stiff, the Good News Bible is a good version. I don't object to that. It's very simple and very clear. And generally speaking, I found it to be accurate. I still use, personally, the Revised Standard Version because I think it's closer to the actual text and a bit wooden in places. But that helps me because I know what the wooden thing refers to. I mean, there's a certain help for me as a student of the Bible trying to find out what the Hebrew would have been or the Greek would have been. I can guess very quickly. But when you paraphrase a bit, you can't guess from just the English what the Hebrew or Greek would be most likely to be at a point. So I would say the Good News Bible is a perfectly good translation, very easily read, and basically pretty accurate.
Is the Good News the same as the Jerusalem
Bible? No. The Jerusalem Bible is quite different. The Jerusalem Bible is done originally in French and is an absolutely magnificent translation in terms of poetry. If you're reading the Psalms, you won't find a better poetic version than the Jerusalem Bible. And it's basically quite accurate, but here and there it gets rather poetic and a little bit flowery, and I think if you're talking about simple translations, the Good News is just as good. The New English Bible is, I think, a little bit too wordy in places, and I think from my study a little bit has some certain tendencies to be focusing on some things that particular preachers or scholars wanted to have in the Bible, in that text, because it was a committee deal. The New RSV also will be a committee deal. It's quite a few changes will happen in the New RSV when it comes out in a couple of years.
Is an American translation coming out too? Have you seen
Yeah, there are lots of other translations. That one I'm not that familiar with. The New International Bible is quite good too, apparently. But I would just say, for your purposes, everyday purposes, Good News Bible, as good as any. All right, now, one more thing before we can leave this text and try to get a second to two or three more. There's a one more thing happens that really makes the particular Pharisees and the people in the synagogue angry, and that is he says, you're not going to accept me because there's been a tradition of the hometown boy being not believable. And then he points to two stories. One is Elijah and the other is Elisha. One is about the widow of Zarephath and the other is about Naaman the Syrian. Why do those two particular stories make the people upset?
They're foreigners.
They're foreigners. It wasn't even hometown. It wasn't even home country. He went to a foreign country. Yeah.
They're ministering to foreigners. Anyway.
Right.
Elijah and Elijah.
Right. One case it happens to be a leader of society, but the other case it happens to be a poor widow. But that just because I'm coming to preach doesn't mean that you're going to accept me, and God is going to be preaching to those people who you will find unacceptable. And the whole threat to their value system, to their structure, is such that they want to lynch him. And yet he's just beginning the ministry. They see the potential threat of this particular man, a threat which also the great leaders of the society saw in Jerusalem later on, and his crucifixion is anticipated by this threatening situation. He doesn't want to come and preach to be a Messiah and a king and overthrow the Romans. See, these Pharisees probably thought they were oppressed by the Romans, when in fact he turns the whole thing around and suggests they are the oppressors in the situation. Any comments or questions further about this?
Doesn't he also say that? Doesn't he also say that, you know, that the kingdom that Isaiah prophesied is going to be for somebody else, and not for you, or it's
yeah, and they're implying he's implying that there's going to be fulfilled for somebody else than for those guys who were sitting there. That's right. And that's, well, we've been reading the text here for generations in the synagogue, and we've always said it applies to us. And so the liberation is going to be us who are the people under the Romans. And the hope of a Messiah was of a political ruler who would, in fact, lead them out of their so-called captivity. The they had a very good arrangement with the Romans. Basically. And they'd worked out a deal. They knew how to live with whoever they were, who was in charge of. Okay. Yes. Bill.
I guess I'm always concerned when we read texts like this that we don't buy into some of the old stereotypes about, you know, all the Pharisees being evil or being oppressors. I mean, it's pretty obvious that Jesus shared many of the ideas that the Pharisees had, or many points on which they were actually agreed, and many of the arguments are on finer points in Torah, and to, you know, to again to whitewash the whole group, or not to whitewash them, to tar them with the same brush, I think is a very dangerous thing for us, and we tend to do that all the time.
Well, I think the text tends to do that somewhat. It puts the Pharisees up as the enemy. As a group, they are the group he's opposing. That doesn't mean there aren't good people, you know, amongst the Jewish leaders, Joseph of Arimathea and so on. You have leaders who also were sympathetic. But as a group, they are the ones he strikes against. But the point is well taken. Thanks. Yes?
It seems to me like the people in the synagogue really don't get too upset in the beginning when Jesus is even talking about the acceptable year of the Lord. It's when he moves from theory to actual stories about where people have put that into practice that folk really get upset.
Yeah.
And in the same way, we talk about the and make resolutions about the poor and third world, but that's okay, but it's not until we go to put it into practice where we really get upset.
Yeah. And one of the texts later on, I think, will illustrate that again, similar way. Thanks for that point. It's of course true. And it's difficult for me. I was in India, and there are people who really are doing this. A man by the name of Brother James has spent the last 30 years just living with villagers and working with them and identifying so totally with the poor that when the government tries to throw him out, there's an uprising, you know, amongst the poor. And that guy is somebody whom I can say really does it. But he's given up family and home and children and everything just to do that for his whole life. And that's really quite a sacrifice. And how many of us are willing to do that and at what level? But that's where the crunch is. He is doing it. And there are a few other people like that. For us who live in this society, it's very difficult to ask the question of how we identify with the poor, how we become Jesus, Christ in our society, or to other people who really are suffering.
Norm?
Yeah?
I agree with you about the spiritualization of the text, that we tend to do that. But, I mean, I know the reason for it. The reason for it is that we who are the upper 10% elite of the world are looking for a word for us.
And
the word for us, it's not, the word for us isn't only condemnation.
No, no.
There is a word for us somewhere.
I'm not saying the word for us is condemnation. I'm saying that that if you say you want to stick with the Pharisees' line, then it's in condemnation.
Yes.
That you have all of the passages are referring to us, and that we will be blessed to, and all the rest of it. No, the word for us is that we are to throw our lot in with those who are oppressed. That we are called to be like Christ. Christ is not necessarily the upper class or the absolute beggars of society, as he's probably somewhere, you know, his father was a carpenter, that doesn't make him one of the absolute bottom. But his role is to identify with the poor and struggle with the poor, to change things, to bring about both uplift spiritually and economically and humanly in the society. And for us, just like the blacks who are saying, unless you are willing to identify with us in our struggle, you are staying on the side of the silent oppressor. But to be silent is to be an oppressor. To speak out for the struggles for liberation and freedom and alleviation of oppression and poverty, that's where we have to be. Now, how we do that, it's somewhat new for us, because we've tended to be saying this only, well, we will give to an orphanage or something, you know? But giving a little money is really not doing anything other than a cosmetic job for what we're truly talking about in terms of the real suffering. I'll repeat something that I said before, earlier. In India, there are 300 million people who are below the poverty line. 300 million. Now, the poverty line is $1 a day. And you're not sure you're going to get that every day if you're a coolie worker. You can't buy much food for $1 a day. Now, the point is, as India is probably in a far worse state than many of these other countries like Nicaragua, because it's such a sort of passive suffering that's going on, and it doesn't get the press that other countries get. But the need is huge. What is the poverty line in this country? You probably know.
Median is above 20,000 per family of four. I think it's
six. That's that poverty line. Poverty line somewhere around 14,000 for an average.
$14,000 a year.
Because it's 60%.
All right, $40,000 a year is how much a day? Well, my mathematics are not that fast, but it's a lot more than a dollar anyway.
About $7 an hour.
$7 an hour. Okay, $7 an hour. Now, in India, you probably would get 10 cents an hour. I mean, that illustrates the nature of the problem. The need for us to identify with those who are struggling and find ways in which our life can be geared into that or linked into it, either through a congregation that finally gets its conscience in order and is working at that. Some people are involved in sanctuary movements. Others are involved in other things. But there are ways in which we can be linked into it as we grow in our ties with other countries or in trying to change the social structures of this society. And unless things happen in changing the social structures of this society, America will continue to be viewed by the rest of the world as oppressors who have given huge aid to these countries, which make them endlessly dependent on America. And so that kind of captivity to American mores and money is still there in many of the third world countries. All right, let's go to some more texts. Otherwise, we will be... I won't answer any of the questions that people ask. Another text, which is striking, is that Zacchaeus and the sycamore tree. Luke 19, 1 to 10. Just very briefly, this one doesn't have to be take so much time. Luke 19, 1 to 10, it's a story about Zacchaeus. And this is a reversal picture, because Zacchaeus in this case was rich. And so it's a story not of the poor, but of a rich man. And therefore gives us a slightly different picture of what happens when a rich man confronts Jesus. Now, Zacchaeus was not only rich, his job was what? Tax collector. Well, if you've lived in India, you know that anybody who collects money of any kind is going to automatically take a portion for himself or herself. It's just the way that things are in those societies. And the assumption was that I, as principal of international school, was automatically going to be getting some rip-off somewhere. And there were all kinds of stories about how many hundreds of thousands of dollars I got through building this building and doing that. It was just assumed that that rumor could be true. I didn't take a penny, by the way. In fact, I lost money right, left, and center by being there. That didn't matter. The point is, the assumption is there. And of course, the tax collector was doing what every other tax collector was doing. Namely, he made a lot of money out of the fact that he was being a tax collector. Correct? Now, in this particular case, then Jesus is coming, and for some reason or another, he is short. And short people tend to be humbler than others, they tell me. And he climbed up this sycamore tree, and as he goes past, this man, like a little kid, climbs up the tree. He doesn't do like a lot of rich and important people do, say, well, you should come and see me. Please come and call on me. I mean, in India, all this time, people would say, I am the prime minister, or I am whatever it is. You have to kowtow. This guy shows some measure that he is just standing on the side and is not demanding that Jesus come to him. So as a result, Jesus says to him, come down, I'm going to go to your house today, in verse 5. He comes down and does so, and as soon as he goes to the house, Jesus goes to the house of Zacchaeus, then people are upset. Verse 7, they saw it, they all murmured, he has gone to be the guest of the man who is a sinner. So the problem was that Jesus was now hobnobbing with people, not so much the problem that he was rich, but first and foremost that he was a sinner. He was a sinner not because he was one of the bottom of society, but because he was one of the ones who was rejected by the religious of the society as being, therefore, somehow or another less than they were. So once again, Jesus is identifying not with the run-of-the-mill religious, but those people who are regarded by the society as outcast and rejected and sinners. Is there anything else especially about this particular tax collector that would make him clearly an outcast in people's minds?
Perhaps his stature?
Yeah, he's just a little runt.
Any deformity or illness is considered some sort of punishment or...
All sorts of indications that you're this squinty little fellow who keeps taking our money. He's clearly marked as being out of it, not one of the acceptable, religious, righteous center of society. Right. Then verse 8. Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, Beloved Lord, the half of my goods I will give to the poor. I'm sorry, a bit further. No, that's right. Zacchaeus said, half of the goods I will give to the poor. Quite clearly, the very fact that Jesus comes to his house turns this person around and makes him realize that this individual is accepting him in a way that no one else has done before. So he's ready to give half of his goods to the poor. Now there is, in fact, a very concrete and practical indication of what happens when you confront the Jesus of the poor. He gives half of his goods to the poor, redistributes his wealth. That's not enough then. He goes the next step and he says, if I've defrauded anyone of anything, I will restore it fourfold. He's going to be broke.
Absolutely. Half of it's gone already.
And whatever else he's got left, if I'm going to give fourfold, and most of that other half will have been stolen money, he's going to have to find money. He's going to be broke. In other words, this man is completely and totally reversing himself and his way and his structure in society. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house, since he is also a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save the lost. Now it's interesting that to seek and to save the lost is identified with the rich man who dares, who is a sinner and an outcast, who now identifies with the needs of the poor. So the lost, we often understand the lost as those who are sinfully lost in their relationship because they may have been alcoholics or whatever. But the lost here is not, has it's an economic dimension to it as well, a social dimension. That's the important thing and interesting. Questions?
Did he do it though? Did he actually do it, follow up?
My assumption is that he does. The story doesn't give us the, you know, the PS. He went out and he was lying to Jesus. No, I think the story implies that he did do it.
Well, likely had not ended up in the scriptures if he had got it turned out to be a
charlatan. Right, if he was a charlatan, I think we probably wouldn't have had it in the text. Yeah.
He must have had, there probably would have been some further stories of Zacchaeus that were known. In the,
yeah, there would have been.
Get in.
Yeah. Now, this is described very nicely in this book. I won't have time to read it today, but if you want to have this way in which how the ordinary people who are the poor are, read this text, there is a clear picture of he must have had nothing, been left with nothing, as Olivia said. At first, he only intended to give half of what he said he had, which according to him was honestly earned, and to give four times back what he'd stolen. But afterwards, he gradually realized that everything he had was stolen.
Would have his fellows been forgiving of him and accepting of him after he had done this?
Well, no, of course not.
He would have still remained an outcast.
It would have taken a lot. I mean, but those people who had been defrauded must have been shocked out of their system. I'm coming to give you $50,000 today because I actually cheated you. You what? How many people have ever taken money back that you've gotten illegally? How many of you have given? I mean, all of us probably at some point have gotten some little extra that we, that really was, that was a bit of gravy, but do we take it back? I mean, how much of the government given back to anybody? I mean, the whole idea of getting money back from somebody that was illegal, if we got that back to came back to us, it would shock us. And yet, that's clearly what happened here. So the fact of him going around giving the money back is probably part of the reason why the story got remembered. You know? Yeah, I remember that guy. He gave me some money one day. Striking business. If you keep have people going around giving you money that you stole for them.
I think the story also implies that Zacchaeus understood who Jesus was and what he was all about,
yeah,
in relation to Luke 4.
I think so. I mean, and he is, in a sense, a model of what we're talking about. Here is a rich man, while he mightn't be one of the righteous rich like you, he was a sinful rich person, and he identifies with where Jesus is going. As that, in that sense, he's a model. That's a very good point.
You have to contrast this and the other, Luke's other book in Acts, where Ananias and Sapphira ostensibly do the same thing, only they cheat.
Right.
And that's brought out. So the two stories have to be put in contrast.
That's a very good point. Ananias and Sapphira, they cheat. They don't actually do it.
Yeah.
Good point. All right, let's go to one more text before we close. Huh?
One more comment that's interesting to me about this text and others in Luke is that Jesus' acceptance of Zacchaeus is totally unconditional and comes first. You know, he doesn't say, Zacchaeus, you
have to do this and this.
Do this first, and then I'll come to your house.
That happens many times, actually. It happens with the woman who comes to anoint him with her feet. his feet with her oil, and so forth. He simply accepts them, and the very act of acceptance of somebody who's an outsider by this man is such a kind of transforming event that they themselves change. And that act of acceptance of the outcast and the outsiders, something for us that's very difficult to do.
Could you look at this in another way? That up until this time, this Zacchaeus' God really was his money or the accumulation. Now he sees Jesus, and this gives him a new...
Well, it's total transformation of where the real values of his life are going to be. Right. Now let's take a third text, and we'll go to the very end of things and turn to Matthew 25. And this is the text about the final judgment, which is a kind of vision that Jesus has in order to make a point. I don't think we should be taking this text as an actual photograph of what's going to happen on the last day, but a point that he wants to make about things at the end and the value system related to his Magna Carta at the beginning. Chapter 25, verse 31. And when the Son of Man comes in his glory, this is Matthew, I'm sorry, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with them, he will sit on his glorious throne, and before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another as shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on the right and the goats on the left, and then the king will say to those on the right hand, "Come, O blessed of the Father, inherit the kingdom which is prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." And then the righteous will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? When did we see this you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer, "Truly, I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of my brethren, you did it to me." And then it goes on with the left hand as well. All right. What is it that is so remarkable about this scene? The people who are recognized on the final day are who?
The ones who help the poor.
The ones who have actually helped the poor and those in prison. You're referring back again to that Magna Carta text, to what Jesus was talking about. The people who have helped the poor, those who have had human concern for those in trouble, wherever they may be. Now, what's surprising about that is that they had a slight problem with Jesus saying, "You've done that." They weren't conscious. They were not doing it for the reward of getting in heaven. They were doing it because they were doing it. Because they were good people, they were righteous people, that's why they were doing it. They weren't doing it to get the reward. And so when they get this gift of the right-hand side, they say, "Well, I don't, me?" That's the surprising thing. And very often we are caught in the trap of saying, we're going to do all these things so that we will get heaven. Heaven is a gift of ours. And these particular people are given recognition at the time of the gift, even though they are not doing it consciously, and they're not aware of what they're doing, as something that will be recognized. They're not doing it to be recognized. And that's another important one. Now, these people are doing it, and they are then recognized by the Lord himself. Is there anything else that's unusual about these people that are being recognized? The ones who are the righteous are those who identify with the poor and the oppressed. Righteousness is not keeping the rules of Moses anymore. Righteousness is the identification with the suffering people of God, or people anywhere. One of the things that is in this text that I have never really noticed before, until I read it again this time, is to ask the question, where is the judge in all of this? Where is the king? Now, the king for us is always sitting on the throne, and we remember him, there he's the king, he's the Lord. All right, Christ the Lord is there, and he has the judgment seat. But far as we're concerned, we're not yet at the judgment seat. Where is the judge? Where is the king? Where is the Lord?
In our hearts.
Everywhere.
So
he's the poor person.
Right. Inasmuch as you have done it to the least of these brethren, you have done it to
me.
Where is he?
Everywhere.
Not sitting up there in heaven waiting for the judgment. As if that's the way you orient your life to the day, if you orient your life towards the final judgment, you're going to be forever worried about the decision. Huh? You don't have to think about that judgment day. He's saying, if you want to be aware of me, I am wherever you do this to the poor and the needy. That's where you'll find me. And as much as you did it to the brethren, you did it to me. God is here amongst the poor and the suffering and the people in prison, and that's where you'll find him. And you'll find him, and you won't be concerned about the judgment. When you get there, it'll be a big surprise that he's up there on top as well. That's the picture that's here. And that's a very striking point, isn't it? It's a very powerful point. Our tendency is to look for God in church or for in heaven or somewhere else. If you want to listen to this passage, as you'll find Christ wherever there is suffering. Yeah.
I'm reading this book, Words to Love by Mother Teresa, and that's exactly what she's saying here.
Yeah.
This is where she finds Christ in the poorest of the poor.
Right. Yeah. Extraordinary woman. Tough as a nail.
Yeah.
Oh. She has that place running so that, in fact, you know, the corruption is out and all this stuff. Tough, but fantastic. Tough love is the right word for her.
Have you met her personally?
No, I've been to her place. She's preceded me in a few places here and there. I just kept missing it. That really is not that important that I met her. But I know enough about her. I know the people who work with her. I know the system. And I have nothing but a praise for what she's done. Her orphanage's plan is a good one. Most of the orphanage plans are hopeless. Mm-hmm. And adoption systems are awful. But hers is good. She is very fine. A system that runs throughout the country.
Obviously she's a very brilliant woman and a good administrator. How does she delegate? Does she keep her hand in everything?
No, she delegates, but she has very tough training programs for the people. If you're going to work with her, you've got to learn to, not just be develop dependency in people. People who work with her have got to learn to be sufficient as well. She has taught, has developed a system of self-sufficiency, which is fundamental to change. If you do like so many of the missionaries did, not all I'm saying, but many, you develop a sense of dependency in people instead of, as it were, changing them to develop their own future. And we had it all the time. Every night, somebody was at our door, usually half a dozen people. Ma, ma, ma. I would call out to my wife because I never would call out to me first, and try and soften her up first. And they would like they want handouts all the time. Handouts, and this handout, of course, is simply not going to solve the problem. Charity is not the answer. The answer is some kind of processes of training people to help themselves. Development has to be self-help process. And so money that just goes for handouts usually just continues to go down into handouts. But money that goes for programs that really do help people to change are the effective programs. And by the way, the money from the village that you gave to us last year over in India is going to assist a program called the Grahini Program, which is for women between the ages of 15 and 25 who are out in the villages, who've had no education and are going to be trained to be able to take care of animals, health care and so on, so they can go back into the villages and be agents of change. And that's the kind of place where the money should be going. So if you gave last year, you can be assured in this particular case the money is going to a program for developing people's sufficiency, at least at a very basic level. One more thing in this text that we often miss, because we are conditioned as Lutherans to see our standing before the judgment throne as individuals. And I'm sure that most of you have read this saying, well, how about me, how about me, how about me? Go back to the very first verse of the text, first verses. Who is standing before the Lord?
The nations.
The nations are standing before him. And it's the nations that he puts to the left and the right. That suggests something else is going on, that not only is there an individual concern, and I think our problem is that we've focused on this in terms of us as individuals standing before the throne, when in fact it's the nations that will be judged. Where is your nation going to come off? The nations. So if you take these particular examples and say, does your nation concern itself for the people who are oppressed? Does your nation concern itself for those people who are imprisoned and so on and so on? Then the judgment falls fairly heavy. I don't mean to say that everybody in every nation is condemned. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that we have tended not to mix politics and religion, and therefore we have said, well, this really only applies to people's spiritual dimensions and not to how they relate to people in terms of their political and economic struggles in the world. But the nations are up for judgment. And you have that same thing happening as an Old Testament carryover. Jeremiah has the judgment of the nations, and so does Amos. And if you look at the beginning of Amos, the judgment on all of the nations that he produces, not because they worship false gods, but because they have been inhuman to other human beings. You've burned people in line, he said. That's not on. And so it is that you have a judgment here. The text should be kept as a portrait not only of God's judgment on people who have not dared to concern themselves with the poor, but also of nations. And I would like to suggest that if you go through that and you say, where does America stand? You will find that so much of our political and economic policy is concerned with oppressing the poor instead of the other way around. To spend, what's the percentage of our budget, America's budget on defense? I don't know. 30%? I don't know, some enormous figure. And for education, it's 5%. And for welfare, foreign aid is how much? And how much of the foreign aid gets to where it ought to be? And there are all kinds of huge questions that need to be asked about America or Australia, whom I'm ashamed of in recent times, because they are not identifying with the poor. New Zealand has just put into its constitution that it's a nuclear free country. And no American can now bring a ship into that port or a plane that's got any nuclear weapons or arms on it. New Zealand has begun to try and do something, at least, to overcome the problem of the nuclear presence in the Pacific. Now that's a major step forward. But concern for the poor and all those other things are still a problem for all most of the third world countries. All right, any questions about this particular text? A lot more could be said. Our time is almost up. We have a couple of minutes left. And I don't really want to start a whole new text because of the time. One person, however, suggested that we might look at the question of the centurion's slave. And in that particular case, if you look at Luke chapter 7, just briefly, Luke chapter 7, you have the centurion saved. In that particular story, the centurion is, of course, a leader in society. Jesus is not afraid to confront the leaders as well as the poor in terms of his program. The striking thing about this particular story is, and in terms of reading it from the bottom, is that this centurion, the people say, look, Jesus is a very important man. It's worthwhile going to see him. You really should see this guy. Which is, of course, what you get all the time if somebody's important. And Jesus agrees, well, I'll go and see him. Apparently having some sort of foresight, because the person who was suffering was not the centurion, but the slave. Right. So Jesus does go. But in this particular case, the centurion doesn't actually even demand, as most people in authority and power would be, that you come to my house and, you know, I'm the important person. Just the opposite, this centurion shows an indication of humility and that his status is not as important as his
slave.
That's extraordinarily important in this text. His status is not as important as his slave. He knows that if he comes out of his house and doesn't do what a big man is expected to, sit there and receive the guest. You come to the big man's house, not the other way around. Jesus is only halfway there when the centurion comes out, leaves his house, goes all the way to meet Jesus when he hears he's coming, and says to Jesus, "You don't have to come to my house. I know what it is to have authority. And you have authority over sickness and healing and death. If you have that authority, then you can do what you have to do right here. You don't have to come to my house." So the centurion is both a Roman and therefore outside of the Jewish tradition. That's one thing that's a mark against him. The second thing is he doesn't act like a man who is in authority. He acts like a person whose slave is more important than his status. So again, a powerful story. And so we could go on. Jesus doesn't act as Lord in these stories. He acts as a man who will identify with the poor and the suffering. And he calls us to look at the Bible from the bottom, from the point of view of those people who are suffering. And he calls us to live our life with that kind of concern. And what change that may mean in your life or in mine is for you and me individually to decide. But I hope that this week has meant that some kind of new sensitivity to how powerful the Bible can be has been brought to your senses. Thanks very much for it.